So when I was in high school and college, I always thought that I knew what job I was going to do when I grew up. I was going to be a lawyer. So I prepared myself well, and I signed up for the LSAT, the prep course for taking the law exam before getting into law school, 2 hours away from my university, and I drove, and I took the preparation class so that I could do really well on the LSATs. And then I took the LSATs, and I failed the LSATs. I essentially don't think like a lawyer. So I thought to myself, now what? This was going to be my future. This was going to be who I was. I had taken philosophy of law and business law and sociology of law. What next? And I'm very grateful to a friend of mine at the time who said to me, Tova, I don't quite understand why you're having this existential angst. When I, in my church, we were developing a new church. We were trying to decide who should be a deacon. So what we did was we said, okay, there's two ways we can figure out who's going to be a deacon in our new church. We could create a job description and list all the qualities of a deacon, and then find someone and say, hey, do you want to do this job description? Or we could find people who are already behaving like a deacon and say, hey, person who's doing this job already, would you like the title of a deacon? She said, Tova, what have you done for the last 4 years in university? I was like, okay, so start a campus chapter of Habitat for Humanity. And she's like, and what are you doing next year? I was like, oh yeah, I'm already signed up to be a volunteer in Service to America. I'm going to Utah, and I'm gonna work with battered women in Utah. But after that, I was gonna go to law school. She's like, Tova, you already are a social worker. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's true. Okay. So now mind shift, now like a little less existential angst. But in the meantime, I went and saw the movie Philadelphia, which ages me, I know, because it was in the 90s. And I saw the movie with some friends, and after I saw the movie, I was just an emotional mess. I saw these people who were dying of AIDS, and they were isolated and alone, and I thought, well, how could that be? How could they be alone? Don't they have a community? Don't they have people who want to care for them? And I said to myself, when I get to Utah, Salt Lake City, Utah, I'm going to explore this more. And the way I explored what was interesting to me is I volunteered. So I'm working during the day as a battered women's shelter, as a volunteer coordinator. But at night, I went to the Utah AIDS Foundation and became a volunteer to deliver meals to men dying of AIDS. Now, in the 90s, before protease inhibitors, AIDS was a death sentence. So here I am showing up with my meal delivery partner to deliver meals to men who are dying of AIDS. And nice Jewish girl from New Jersey, really nothing in common, 21 years old, you know? And but what I did have was an open heart and a willing soul. Because at this point in the 90s, people didn't really understand standard precautions and universal precautions. And people were afraid to get near people with AIDS because they thought, if I get too close, I'm also going to die. And I went and delivered meals, and I spent some time, 2 years I ended up doing this. And what I discovered with these amazing people were that when you're at your end of your life, you just don't have time for crap. You just don't have time for small stuff. And you go right heart to heart. And it was the most authentic relationships that I had had in my life in the quickest time. And they welcomed me into their lives, into their hearts, the caregivers, the men dying of AIDS. I went to funerals and I developed relationships. And it changed my heart. During these 2 years, my grandmother in Texas, who was on dialysis, got pneumonia. And I was called to go from Salt Lake to Texas, to Dallas, to visit her. And she said to me when I was with her, I'm tired. I'm really tired. Anybody who knows about dialysis, like, everybody's half alive. And she was like, I'm just tired of being half alive. 3 days a week, it's just taking too much out of me. And my parents had divorced when I was young, and my grandmother had been an enormous stabilizing and important figure in my life. She had flown out to be in Jersey with my single mom for months on end, caring for us and being there for us. And she was one of the most stabilizing figures in my life growing up. And I was devastated. But somehow, in, again, 21, just remember, had the peace of mind to understand that I needed to tell her how important she was to me, that there might not be another chance. So for 8 days, I went in the morning and stayed all day and spent that time with my grandmother. And I searched my heart of hearts from side to side and said everything that I felt like I needed to say to her about how important she was to me, how her visits, you know, what they meant to me and our relationship. And I said to myself, like, I may not see her alive again. I really was certain I would not, especially because she had sort of said she was giving up and she just didn't have that oomph for life anymore. And I did life review with my grandmother without even understanding what life review was. And I did relationship closure without even understanding what it was. But I somehow had the insight that if not now, when, there was no other opportunity. So I went home after 8 days to Utah, to Salt Lake City, to continue my work. And she died the next day. I got back on a plane, went back to Dallas, went to the funeral, and went to Shiva. And what I noticed at Shiva was that I was the one who had done this thing called anticipatory grieving, which now I know what it's called. I didn't know what it was called then. That I had spent 8 days preparing myself for her to die. And that I was in a place of peace and emotional settlement that no one else in my family was feeling. And I was like, oh, lucky me. That 8 days felt like a gift, felt like a blessing. So this combination ended up being the 1-2 punch, I should just say. Fast forward years later, I went to grad school, University of Maryland School of Social Work. During my time at University of Maryland, I volunteered at the Missionaries of Charity, Mother Teresa's, had an AIDS hospice, not so far from here, actually, that I would go while I was in grad school and volunteer with people with AIDS. And when I was done graduating and I was trying to think, because thank God in social work you can sort of be anyone you want to be and do anything you want to do, I had worked at the House of Ruth and I had worked at this battered women's shelter in Utah. And I was like, battered women, what should I do? What do I want? And I was like, you know, remember that hospice work, that death and dying work? I loved that. Let's go back. Let's see if that's it. So I got my first hospice job, and I had an amazing mentor. I was working in an inner city inpatient unit. If anybody knows about an inpatient unit, you know that they rock. They're amazing. And I got this job, and I looked around the room. And when I looked around the room, I noticed something very special. At the time, I was the youngest practitioner in the room. The other chaplains, doctors, nurses, they were much older than I was, because nobody at that point in their life, in their late 20s and their early 30s, thought death and dying was the thing to do. Because part of what you need to do, because people call me all the time and say, like, I'm interested in going in hospice, what do I need to know? And I'm always like, you have to come to terms with your own mortality. You have to face the fact every day when you go to work and you work with clients and patients that could be your mother, your brother, your sister, your cousin, your child. I worked with children. I worked with adults. I worked with women who looked like my mother. I worked with them all. And if you can't come to terms that there but for the grace of God, I myself could be in that bed or my loved one could be in that bed, you cannot have the special magical resilience that you need to do the work day in and day out. So I tell the story of a nurse I worked with, and we were doing a joint visit to elucidate this point, because it was a hospice nurse, my favorite part. Like, you think the hospice nurse has got it. So we're bedside with a woman who is transitioning, which is hospice lingo for alert enough, but on the cusp of actively dying, in her 50s with cancer and 4 teenage children. And I'm saying to her, the children who I did not know, we were on an initial visit, and I said, let's search your heart of hearts and say the things that Dr. Byak, Ira Byak would say, the 5 things I love you for, thank you for, please forgive me for, I forgive you for, and goodbye. The 5 things that matter most, because these are the last moments that your mother can even acknowledge your presence. And if we do this right, that I could save you thousands of dollars of therapy in the future. Honest. And I was like holding some tense silence. Four teenage boys, they weren't making eye contact. They weren't interested in what I had to say. And the nurse who was standing next to me was so uncomfortable with the tension that I created after, in that pregnant pause, after I'd said what I'd said. She said, "Or not. Or not. You could just not do relationship closure and, you know, talk to your mom before she dies. And you could just, you know, not." My husband likes to call this the "or not" lady. Because she was a hospice nurse. And what I tell the story only to say this "or not" lady, because it's to explain that even hospice workers have a hard time dealing with this day in and day out. But what I learned was how heart-to-heart, how authentic, how you're invited into the most intimate moments of people's lives as a doula for the dying, and how meaningful it is, because I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, if I'm involved, it may not be good, but it will be better. And that with the help of God, they can have not, maybe it's not the best, but what we call in hospice lingo, a good death. So 25 years later, what I learned is I didn't find a job. I found a job and a calling.